Jacob and how the Lord gave him a new name, and how we sang that song, we have a new name in glory. I think Debbie and I were talking a little about this afterwards, and maybe some of you were thinking about this too. It's not the idea, and that's where people get a wrong concept maybe of this, of thinking that we have a new name and glory is going to be ours, a new name. That the Lord is going to call us by a different name. You know, instead of Michael, it'd be something else. I don't think that's what it means. He has given us a new name. I don't think it means that the names that our parents have given us, that's how we got our name, by the way, you know, that they had the wherewithal to name us what they have. I don't think he means that he's going to change that. I think what it means, though, is what we do have a new name written in glory. But I think what that means, signifies, and what that means is that we are no longer just belong to ourselves. We have a new name because of Christ. Our new name in glory is related to that. We have that new name only because of him. So that new name is connected to him. Not that he's going to change our first names or our middle names and such, but that we belong to him. When we're Christians, when we become a Christian, we belong to him. He's bought and paid for us. That's what Paul tells us. He bought and paid for, with his blood, the church. And see, we don't partake of that, and we don't get that new name unless we become part of that. You might think that, you know, that Jesus just he died for people individually, but scriptures don't teach us that. He died for the church. It's a corporate thing. And as I was saying last week to some, it's that it's not that there's not an individual aspect to it. There is. Because the choice we make for Christ, that's an individual choice. That's not a corporate choice. See, that's why, and we were talking about that a little bit this morning downstairs. Michael was bringing this up, and many people grow up that way. It's that when you are, like, say, confirmed in the Catholic Church when you're a baby. Well, you grow up, the way you think is, well, I'm Catholic. You know, I'm Christian. You know, I was since I was a baby. Or since you're Lutheran or any other group. You know, that you grow up thinking, well, this is what I am. This is who I am. That when many people, you ask them, that's what they'll say. And that's why they think that they may be Christian. That they are, but they're really not. And it's just like I've said, when we die, the Lord's not going to say, because you were part of this family, you know, because you were, say, part of the by the way family, the Lot family, that whatever family it may be, Hansen, what have you, Johansson, what have you. Just because you're of that family, the Lord's not going to say, because you're that family, come on in.
Abraham.
What's that?
Abraham.
Abraham, yeah, because you're of that, that come on in. No, he's not going to say that. It's to the individual. Yes, we have to be part of the family of God. That is the church. But the choice is ours individually. So I just want to bring that out. But this morning I want to turn to a short book we're going to deal with. It's only 21 verses. The book of Obadiah. And I'm giving you a contrast between Jacob and Esau in the last 2 weeks. And now I want to bring this down to show you what resulted from that. And relate that to today as well. The book of Obadiah is the shortest book in the Old Testament. Just 21 verses in length. It's found right after Amos and right before Jonah. If you want to locate that, have trouble locating it. The prophet here, Obadiah, is speaking against Edom, which was Israel's neighbor to the south. This is a prophecy of doom against Edom for mistreating Judah in a time of adversity. Obadiah prophesied in Judah sometime before the ministry and the prophecy and prophetic time of Jeremiah. And the reason I bring this up, and we're going to go over Obadiah, is because the Edomites were descendants of Esau, Jacob's brother, and they were the inveterate, mean that's a word, enemies of Israel. But they were related. Because of Jacob and Esau. The great Scottish biblical scholar and minister of years gone by in the 19th century, George Campbell Morgan, said this: Esau and Edom occupy a place of profound significance in the divine revelation of truth. That significance is brought into sharp focus in this small prophecy of Obadiah. The background of the picture presented to us by Obadiah is Jacob. The foreground is Esau. Jacob and those descended from him are seen passing through suffering, which is of the nature of chastisement to ultimate restoration. Esau is seen proud and rebellious and defiant and moving towards ultimate destruction. Those were the words of George Campbell Morgan concerning this prophecy of Obadiah. So now, by way of background, little is known about Obadiah. His personal history, that is. His name, Obadiah, means servant of Yahweh or worshiper of Yahweh. That's what Obadiah means. Well, he lived some 500 years or more before Christ, but we don't know the exact dates of his lifetime. But that being said, what a bleak picture this prophet Obadiah paints of Edom. His tone changes, yes, in verses 17 and 21. In the world that we live in today, it's been that way for many years and has not changed. There's a tremendous stress on rights, my rights. Individual rights. Now we have what they call social justice. As Stuart Briscoe says, it almost seems that we are interested in God only to the extent to which he will benefit mankind. And again, that's why I've spoken of the MTD phenomena, the moral therapeutic deism phenomena. And I dare say that we do not meet many people nowadays. How many of us can say that? I dare say that we do not meet many people nowadays who are God-centered. Instead, they're man-centered in their outlook. Or maybe more precisely, they're self-centered. It comes back to the essence of what the Greek philosopher Protagoras said, man is the measure of all things. Man is the measure of all things and the center of the universe. So many people in the world today think that way. Albeit there are those who believe that mankind today, and I've referenced this before, there are those now who believe that mankind should be terminated. And they're publicly saying so. And as I've said before, what we should tell them is, you be the first. But even many of those who claim to belong to Christ often give the unfortunate impression that they take God, and that's the MTV phenomena, that they take God seriously only when it suits them. Most of the time, the things of the world are put on a higher scale. And I believe we have witnessed that a great deal. I believe we've witnessed that a great deal over these last couple of years. It needs to be said, though, that God, Yahweh, takes himself seriously. And he expected the prophets to take him seriously. And he expected his people to take him seriously. And I do believe that he expects people today to take him seriously. What both the prophets, both major and minor, had to say, I believe, and this is why I like to preach out of the prophets every once in a while, is that both the major and minor prophets, what they had to say is just as applicable to today as it was in their day. And as Stuart Briscoe said, Obadiah is assuring us that the authoritative rule of God in the affairs of men, that's mankind, is to be counted on and reckoned with. The kingdom will be the Lord's. So let's look at this little short book, shall we? The prophecy is against Edom, but it is given to Judah. Notice the first words. The vision of Obadiah. Thus says the Lord God concerning Edom. Notice what we have right from the very start here. The very first verse of Obadiah underscores the source of his message. This is important to notice. See, what this is saying is Obadiah is not speaking just of his own accord, just because he hates Edom. the people of Edom. No. The source of his message, it tells us right here, is Yahweh, is God. Thus says the Lord God concerning Edom. We have heard a report from the Lord that we, the source of his message now, is from God. We have heard a report from the Lord, and an envoy has been sent among the nations. Arise, and let us go against her for battle. Behold, I will make you small among the nations. You are greatly despised. That's what God says through Obadiah. Now, in picturing this, you have to look at the territory of Edom now. Edom was southeast of Israel and Judah. And that territory that Esau and his progeny, his descendants, that they occupied and they took over was a wild, was one of the wildest, most barren country areas on the face of the earth. But that's where Esau settled. Israel had a long history with Edom. You go back to the book of Numbers, Numbers chapter 20, verses 14 through 21 lays that out. The Israelites were on their way to the promised land. Now notice what happens here. From Kadesh, Moses then sent messengers to the king of Edom. Thus your brother Israel, notice what Moses told him. Thus your brother Israel has said, you know all the hardship that has befallen us, that our fathers went down to Egypt, and we stayed in Egypt for a long time, over 400 years. And the Egyptians treated us and our fathers badly. But when we cried out to the Lord, he heard our voice and sent an angel and brought us out of Egypt. Now behold, we are at Kadesh, a town on the edge of your territory. Please let us pass through your land. We will not pass through field or through vineyard. We will not even drink water from a well. We will go along the king's highway, not turning to the right or left until we pass through your territory. Sounds pretty reasonable, doesn't it? They're kinfolk. So Moses is pleading with them to let them go through. Now notice what happens. Edom, however, said to him, you shall not pass through us, or I will come out with the sword against you. Again, the sons of Israel said to him, we will go up by the highway, and if I and my livestock do drink any of your water, then I will pay its price. Let me only pass through on my feet, nothing else. But the king of Edom said, you shall not pass through. And Edom came out against him with a heavy force and with a strong hand. Thus Edom refused to allow Israel to pass through his territory. So Israel turned away from him. Kinfolk. Didn't treat him like that, though. Later on, we learned that from 2 Samuel chapter 8 that David conquered the territory of Edom, the Edomites, that they were under subjection to them. And we learned later in 1 Kings and 2 Chronicles how King Solomon exploited the Edomites. So there was a lot of bitterness there. But later in the reign of Uzziah, the Edomites were successful against them. And during the time of Obadiah, several nations here form a coalition who are united in their opposition to Israel. I'm going to notice two things this morning. The first is this. The hand of Yahweh. Notice what it says. Behold, I will make you small among the nations. You are greatly despised. The arrogance of your heart has deceived you. You who live in the clefts of the rock, in the loftiness of your dwelling place, who say in your heart, who will bring me down to earth? Though you build high like the eagle, though you set your nest among the stars, from there I will bring you down, declares the Lord. If thieves came to you, if robbers by night, oh, how you will be ruined. Would they not steal until they had enough? If grape gatherers came to you, would they not leave gleanings? Oh, how Esau will be ransacked. His hidden treasures searched out, and all the men allied with you will send you forth to the border, and the men at peace with you will deceive you and overpower you. They who eat your bread will set an ambush for you. There's no understanding in him. Will I not on that day, declares the Lord, destroy wise men from Edom and understanding from the mountain of Esau? Then your mighty men will be dismayed, O Teman, so that everyone may be cut off from the mountain of Esau by slaughter. Heavy words from Yahweh through Obadiah to Judah. We see the hand of Yahweh here, that God is at work in the military and the political lives of Edom. Now that may seem surprising. As Brother James Smith says, the verb in Hebrew here is in the perfect tense, which normally indicates completed action. That the prophets often use the perfect tense to indicate an outcome which was certain to be accomplished, that it could be spoken of as already accomplished. That's what God, what Yahweh is saying. It's a done deal. You see, the hand of Yahweh, that Yahweh is sovereign, and the ultimate kingdom is his. Still true today, whether people want to believe it or not. You see, if we as Christians, if we believe the Lord is sovereign, that he is moving towards the climax of history and the establishment of his eternal kingdom, what that means is that we must have a different view of things that happen in our world around us than others do. Theology, you want to say, well, what's theology got to do with, you know, the study of God? Well, it's imperative, in fact. It must come first, the study of God, the study of his word. It must come first. Because whatever, and this is what we often forget, and maybe what we have forgotten over in these last few years, is that whatever our political persuasions, whatever it may be, they must be in harmony with the principles of God and his kingdom. Whether that's our political persuasion or whatever we think concerning our lives in that, it must be in conformity with his principles and of his kingdom. That in whatever happens in our world, we must realize that ultimately the kingdom will be the Lord's. That's the last word that you will find in the book of Obadiah. That's how it ends. Now, Yahweh is speaking here through Obadiah to Edom. Notice, God is not at all, through his prophet Obadiah, he is not at all afraid, he's not at all reluctant to tell Edom, to tell the Edomites, to tell Edom the plain and unadulterated judgment is on its way. That's what he's telling them. And Yahweh, through Obadiah, is not hesitant or apologetic about it either. He doesn't apologize for it that is coming. And what he tells them is it's going to come in the form of a military overthrow at the hands of their Arab neighbors. What he's telling them is this, that regardless of the consequences, judgment is coming. And he's giving them ample warning, by the way. That's a lesson for us today. That's always still, it's still God's divine principle. He has given ample warning. He's given ample warning today that his judgment is coming. And we see two aspects of God's character here. God is holy and righteous. And he will judge where judgment is necessary. Still true today. But we also see that God is gracious. He's merciful and loving. And he will always give people ample warning and time to repent. But you see the situation in Edom from Judah's perspective, see? They're bitter enemies. But the kingdom will be the Lord's. Vengeance is mine, saith the Lord. The Lord is in control. That's the second thing that we see here. That's the second thing we notice. The nature of God's action through this Arab coalition against Edom. That's what he's talking about in verse 2. What he says here in verses 2 through 9 here is that the people of Edom think they have a right to be proud. And well, I'm going to come back to that in just a minute, but what's the lesson in here and what the Lord is saying, and that's a lesson today as well, that all great kingdoms and empires have sooner or later, what has happened to them? They've crumbled or fallen, have they not? They haven't lasted. They've fallen into dust. We can get numerous examples of that. The Babylonian Empire, what was going to happen to it? It's going to crumble and fall. The Medes and the Persians, same thing happened to them. The Greeks came on the scene. Well, what happened to the Greeks and their empire? It crumbled and fell into the dust. The same thing with the Roman Empire. And brothers and sisters, there have been kings, Caesars, dictators, and empires, numerous that we could name. And there, they have come and gone. But these rulers have one thing in common. You know what that was? They didn't think about God. God wasn't in their outlook. God wasn't in their view. That's what they all had in common. We must not think that there's the world's out there, that nations out there today, including our own, could not fall into this. God's still in control and he's still on the throne. We must never forget that. Even through all the things that we went through in the last couple of years or so, we must never forget that. God is still on the throne. He's still in control. If we look and we read and stuff and we look around and see, where are those great kingdoms and empires? Yahweh said, I will make you small among the nations. You think you're big now? God said, I will make you small among the nations. And that did happen. Catastrophic defeat for those who would not order their lives according to God's principle. There's no exception to that. That's the same thing today. And what God tells him in verses 5 and 6 there is, and he has Obadiah use some poetic language here, but he's telling them that you think you're wealthy and you've got it made now? He's telling them, saying, it's all going to come to nothing. You're not going to have it. Esau is a symbol here, a synonym rather, not a symbol, but a synonym for Edom. And what God is saying here in verse 7, what he says there, verses 7 and 8, he's telling them that they are going to be totally wiped out. That all those former alliances that they made, they're not going to amount to anything. He's telling them in verses 7 and 8 there and 9, he's telling them their whole structure of their kingdom, of the Edomites, of the nation of Edom, is going to come tumbling down. And like Humpty Dumpty who sat on the wall and had a great fall, no one can pick him up again, just like that. God is picturing Edom. That it would never be picked up again. And how we apply that today, I think we apply it this way. People sometimes disregard the idea of God's judgment. That he does so today. But what does Paul tell us in Galatians chapter 6? Verse 7. What does he tell them there? He said, do not be deceived. God is not mocked. For whatever a man sows, this he will also reap. That's why he says what he does in verse 15. And he lays out to them. God doesn't, he doesn't keep anything back from them. He gives them the reasons for his judgment. He tells them, you're arrogant. You think you've got it made. Self-sufficiency. We don't need anybody. They had no allegiance to any god. And this was one of the almost unique things about the Edomites, about the nation of Edom. They had no allegiance to a god at all, not even any idols. No allegiance. It was just to themselves. They believed that they had all the answers themselves. And God tells them, you think that you have managed to establish yourselves quite firmly. Your location, where you're at, your wealth, your alliances, your pride. What about many people today? Isn't that the same with them? They think that they're self-sufficient, they got it made. Where? It might be wherever they might live, how much money they've got, who their alliances are with. Think of some of the nations today who think that way. The pride that they have. That was one of God's primary complaints. Did you read this? When you read Obadiah here, that's one of God's primary complaints against them, is their pride and how arrogant they were. Goes all the way back to how they treated the Israelites when they were coming to the Promised Land, back in Numbers chapter 20. But you know, that's one of God's primary complaints against people overall, is pride. Remember what God said to Belshazzar through Daniel? The handwriting on the wall? Many, many tekeleth parson. And when Belshazzar saw that being written on the wall, he trembled. He trembled so much, he wet his pants. That's what the Hebrew says. And only Daniel could interpret that. And Belshazzar said, you tell me what that means, I'll give you money. I'll make a segment in the kingdom. Daniel says, keep your money. Keep that. But I'll tell you what it says. I'll tell you what it says. And Daniel proceeded to tell him what it says. We read that in Daniel chapter 5. And what he told him what it says, he said, God has found you wanting. And God has not only found you wanting, but this very night, the kingdom is going to be taken from you. Your life is forfeit. That's what Daniel told them. Imagine hearing that. Well, what was the very first sin of Satan? But pride. What was the very first the sin of actually of Adam and Eve that we read in Genesis? Pride. What does John tell us in 1 John chapter 2, 15 through 17? What sin is? The lust of the eyes, the lust of the flesh, and the boastful pride of life. The Edomites had all of that encompassed within them. We can look at that today and see what people are doing. That's what I saw. Well, I didn't see it. I wouldn't watch such a thing, but that's what I heard about, is what they did at the Grammys, flaunting Satanism. See? That's mocking God. And those things that they did, no. We think of many things, such things like that today. But here's what we see in verse, and going on in verse 11. Look at what it says. On the day that you stood aloof, on the day that strangers carried off his wealth, and foreigners entered his gate and cast lots for Jerusalem, you too were as one of them. Do not gloat over your brother's day, the day of his misfortune, and do not rejoice over the sons of Judah in the day of their destruction. Yes, do not boast in the day of distress. Do not enter the gate of my people in the day of their disaster. Yes, you do not gloat over their calamity in the day of their disaster. And do not loot their wealth in the day of their disaster. Do not stand at the fork of the road to cut down their fugitives. And do not imprison their survivors in the day of their distress. They had a false sense of security there. The Hebrew means what God is saying is that literally to be on the other side, to be opposite, to make no effort to give aid at all. And what he was saying to them that you Edomites, you're maliciously gloating. And that's what they did literally at the destruction of Jerusalem by Nebuchadnezzar. That's what they did. And he tells him in verse 13 there, the ruthless exploitation that they did. But God is telling him that judgment is coming. Judgment is coming, and centuries later, it wasn't just then, but centuries later, that's what happened. The nation of Edom was overrun by the Nabataeans. some Arabs. And they fled to what is known now as known as the rest of the Edomites that were left, fled to what is known as the city of Petra, which now still lies in ruins. Isaiah talked about that in Isaiah chapter 31, verse 1. So if Obadiah's prophecy teaches us anything, it is that those who are proud will fall. That those who exalt themselves, who think they are so self-sufficient, will be humbled by God eventually. That those who trust in their own strength and might will eventually come crashing down, whether it's people or whether it's nations. God is still in control. You have all that worldly wisdom. And the Edomites thought they had it. And as I said, the animosity went all the way back to Esau. And it reached its climax. Brothers and sisters, it reached its climax when Jesus stood before Herod. Because Herod was an Idumean. What was left of the nation of Edom when the Roman Empire came along is they had a little territory southeast, south of Jerusalem, a small little territory left to them called Idumea. That's what Herod was. Herod was actually an Edomite. And we should always remember this. The judgment of God will always fall. May we never forget this as the church. The judgment of God will always fall on those who oppose Him. Always. And it will do so. That's why he mentions in verse 15, as we wrap this up, why he mentions what he does in verse 15. For the day of the Lord, for the day of Yahweh, draws near on all the nations. As you have done, it will be done to you. Your dealings will return on your own head, because just as you drank on my holy mountain, all the nations will drink continually. They will drink and swallow and become as if they had never existed. But on Mount Zion there will be those who escape, and it will be holy. And the house of Jacob will possess their possessions. Then the house of Jacob will be a fire, and the house of Joseph a flame. But the house of Esau stubble. And they will set them on fire and consume them, so that there will be no survivor of the house of Esau. There is no nation of Edom today, nor Edomites. For the Lord has spoken. Then those of the Negev will possess the mountain of Esau, and those of the Shephelah, the Philistine plain, also possess the territory of Ephraim and the territory of Samaria, and Benjamin will possess Gilead. And the exiles of this host of the sons of Israel who are among the Canaanites as far as Zarephath, and the exiles at Jerusalem who are in Zarephath, will possess the cities of the Negev. The deliverers will ascend Mount Zion to judge the mountain of Esau. And the kingdom will be the Lord's. This is the first use in verse 15 in the Old Testament of the term Day of Yahweh, which means Yahweh comes into prominence. And how this prophecy ends and what is in common with the other prophecies of the Bible is just this: doom and judgment. People don't like to hear that today. They don't want to hear it. But in 125 BC, the Edomites were overthrown and they lost their nationhood and their identity. And they became the little territory of Idumea. And that's what happened in 70 AD at the destruction, during the destruction, and after the destruction of Jerusalem. Edom, Idumea, became no more. Not even named in history after that. As Brother James Smith says, Obadiah broadens the blast against Edom to include all those who manifest the same behavior. Those who stand aloof from God's people. Those who mock or persecute the church. Those who desecrate sacred things shall all face the burning wrath of the Holy One of Israel. So they can worship Satan, they can do all these sorts of things that they want to do today. Like putting in idols in these abortion centers and so forth, actual idols in that. They can do all the sorts of things like that. But they will one day face the burning wrath of the Holy One of Israel. See, but what Obadiah teaches us here and shows us here, last of all, is that there's an upside as well as a downside to this prophecy, to all prophecies. All the prophets end on a note of hope. You read verses 17 through 20 there. In marked contrast to what happened to Edom is marked contrast to what happens to God's people. And it shows still that God is sovereign and that He is in charge. What He is doing here, He's given us a picture of the kingdom. That the kingdom, His kingdom, is a place of safety. It's a place of salvation. When He talks about Zion here, that's a spiritual symbol, that is a symbol of spiritual Jerusalem. Read Galatians 4, verse 25 following, you'll see that. He is saying that His kingdom will be triumphant in the end. As we read in Revelation chapter 21 through 22, you see, Obadiah's purpose here, the end here, is not so much to describe the changing map of Palestine as it is to depict in concrete terms that God's kingdom is over all. And His kingdom will progress. You see, Mount Zion here, that's the abode of God's people. That's His kingdom. Mount Esau is the world outside of God. So what's the ultimate lesson in this for us? We must never forget that God works out His purposes in the actions and the affairs of mankind and the nations. He's still doing it today. But know this, but He also says, pride comes before a fall, which many people have not learned, but will learn. And also this, though, I firmly believe this, brothers and sisters, that we need to get this ingrained on our mind. God created us. God created us not to be independent. He created us to be dependent, not just dependent upon each other as far as in the church, but He created us to be dependent upon Him. We are to be dependent upon Him. That's why He created us. That's why in the Hebrew, the last words that are here, and the kingdom will be the Lord's, in the Hebrew, that's only a three-word declaration. Three words in the Hebrew. Not in the English, but in the Hebrew it is. The kingdom will be Yahweh's. And when it comes to it, and when it comes to the end, all of it, the bottom line of all history, the bottom line of all our lives, brothers and sisters, it comes down to that. The kingdom is His. And I think the last part of Obadiah, and the kingdom will be the Lord's, as Brother Smith said, these words should be the polar star for us as God's people through whatever days may be ahead of us. These words should be our polar star. The kingdom will be the Lord's. That's what He's telling through Obadiah to the Edomites. You think it's all yours, and God is saying, it's mine. It's all mine. The kingdom belongs to me. Let's stand, we're going to sing. I'm so glad I'm a part of the family of God. That's what it comes down to, are we? Are we part of that kingdom? We should be, better be.